Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, January 30th, 2026. We turn first to page one, where the main story is about healthcare, titled Caring Teens, Caring Cells. U-High students aim to support kids with sickle cell disease. This story is datelined Normal. Three university high school juniors are working to help kids with sickle cell disease through the Caring Cells project. With Caring Cells, the students, Joshua Walker, Justine Walker, and Giselle Lee, said they hope to support children by making and donating twist-tie blankets and raising awareness about the disease. We kind of want to do two things: reach out to the community, do some good community work, as well as kind of amplify the voices of those with sickle cell, Giselle said. They said they felt passionate about helping the community in some way after learning about the disease during biology class freshman year. The 17-year-olds told the Pantograph they also were motivated to work on this project because they have family members who have the sickle cell trait, and although they don't know anyone personally who has been affected by the disease, Caring Cells has allowed them to hear patient stories and learn more. We came up with the name Caring Cells because we realized that a big part of like what we would want to do is provide care to the kids suffering with sickle cell disease. A big part of what affects them was the sickle cells, so we wanted to show how we care for every cell in their body, Joshua said. Justine, Joshua, and Giselle partnered with Dr. Robert Mulcahy, a hematologist at the University of Illinois Hospital and Clinics, UI Health, in Chicago, as well as a medical student at the University of Illinois Chicago, to connect with patients and learn how to best help them while they are in crisis. Justine said they thought the blankets would provide comfort and relaxation to the kids, recalling when she underwent a minor procedure and received a blanket. She said it was really meaningful to her, knowing that someone was caring for her in that way. The Caring Cells founder said they also want to provide other things to help kids take their minds off their illness, such as arts and craft supplies and other items. Justine said she started making twist-tie blankets as a kid after she received a kit for Christmas. I just remember how fun it was as a kid, so to give these to other kids, I thought that could be a fun experience, she said. Also, to think the work that actually went into making it, I think that could also mean something. Justine also said she hopes to pursue an education in the medical field. Joshua noted each blanket takes about an hour to 90 minutes to make. They plan to donate a blanket to each patient they are connected with at UI Health, and they also said they hope to work with OSF Children's Hospital of Illinois in Peoria, OSF Healthcare St. Joseph Medical Center in Bloomington, and Carl Broman Medical Center in Normal. The students said they don't think their age affects how much of an impact they can make. As teenagers, they said they feel they can relate to the children, and even if it's just the three of them, they are still going to be able to make a difference in their lives. When their parents learned about the project, they were really proud and supported their ideas immediately, the students told the Pantograph. The Caring Cells project will hold its first meeting at 1:15 p.m. Sunday, February 22nd, in Community Room 3 of the Bloomington Public Library at 205 East Olive Street. Mulcahy will join the students to help introduce the project and discuss ways to get involved and goals for the year. They also hope to inspire others to start chapters at their schools. In the future, the students said they hope to host several volunteering events, such as movie nights where they can make the blankets or other activities. This year, they focused on laying down good roots, but they said they hope to continue with the project into college. Our hopes are more that more will know about the disease, Justine said. I think when we advocate, educate, and support, that builds a sense of empathy, which I think it can go a really long way, wanting to help and care. I think that's really important, and what we kind of want the community to take away from the meeting. And to learn more about getting involved, find the Caring Cells Project on Instagram and TikTok. Our next front page story is headlined, Ex-Cop Gets 20 Years for Murder. Grayson shot Massey in her home on 911 call. This is an Associated Press story, datelined Springfield. A former Sangamon County Sheriff's deputy was sentenced Thursday to 20 years in prison for fatally shooting Sonia Massey, who had dialed 911 to report a possible prowler outside her Springfield home. Sean Grayson, 31, was convicted in October of second-degree murder. Grayson, who is white, received the maximum possible sentence. He has been incarcerated since he was charged with murder in this case. He apologized during the sentencing, saying he wished he could bring Massey back and spare her family the pain that he caused. I made a lot of mistakes that night. There were points when I should have acted, and I did not. I froze, he said. I made terrible decisions that night, and I am sorry. But Massey's parents and two children, who lobbied for the maximum sentence, said their lives had changed dramatically since the killing. Her two children said they had to grow up without a mother, while Massey's mother said she lived in fear. They asked the judge to carry out justice in her name. Today I'm afraid to call the police in fear that I might end up like Sonia, her mother, Donna Massey, said. When the judge read the sentence, the family reacted with a loud cheer. Yes, the judge admonished them. After the hearing, Massey's relatives thanked the public for the support and listening to their stories about Massey. 20 years is not enough, her daughter Summer told reporters. In the early morning hours of July 6, 2024, Massey, who struggled with mental health issues, summoned emergency responders because she feared there was a prowler outside her Springfield home. According to body camera footage, Grayson and Sheriff's Deputy Dawson Farley, who was not charged, searched Massey's yard before meeting her at her door. Massey appeared confused and repeatedly said, "Please, God." The deputies entered her house. Grayson noticed the pot on the stove and ordered Farley to move it. Instead, Massey went to the stove, retrieved the pot, and teased Grayson for moving away from the hot, steaming water. And from this moment, the exchange quickly escalated. Massey said, "I rebuke you in the name of Jesus." Grayson drew his sidearm and yelled at her to drop the pan. She set the pot down and ducked behind a counter, but she appeared to pick it up again. And that is when Grayson opened fire on the 36-year-old single mother, shooting her in the face. He testified that he feared Massey would scald him. Grayson was charged with 3 counts of first-degree murder, which could have led to a life sentence, but a jury convicted him of the lesser charge. Illinois allows for a second-degree murder conviction if evidence shows the defendant honestly thought he was in danger, even if that fear was unreasonable. And Massey's family was outraged by the jury's decision. The justice system did exactly what it's designed to do today. It is not meant for us, her cousin, Sante Massey, said after the verdict. Massey's killing raised new questions about U.S. law enforcement shootings of black people in their homes. Civil rights attorney Ben Crump negotiated a $10 million settlement with Sangamon County for Massey's relatives. The case also generated a U.S. Justice Department inquiry that was settled when the county agreed to implement more de-escalation training, collect more use-of-force data, and force the sheriff who hired Grayson to retire. The case also prompted a change in Illinois law requiring fuller transparency on the backgrounds of candidates for law enforcement jobs. Grayson's attorneys had filed a motion for a new trial, which Judge Ryan Cadigan dismissed at the start of the sentencing. And our last front page story is about education, titled Unit 5 Told Not to Close Carlock. This story is datelined Normal. Carlock Elementary School parent Matt Smederevac said shortly after his daughter was born in 2020, she had a blood clot that traveled to her brain that caused a stroke and prolonged seizures. Her doctors advised him that she may be at risk for speech and reading challenges as she got older. But after moving to the west side of McLean County Unit 5 School District and enrolling her in Carlock Elementary School, the school staff helped her to be able to read and test at an advanced level. Smederevac was one of at least 20 supporters who urged the Unit 5 School Board Wednesday not to close Carlock Elementary. "She is in the right place, and we have made the right decision," Smederevac said. The potential closure is one of the options being proposed in a draft enrollment plan produced by Cropper GIS Consulting, an Ohio-based firm the district has used to evaluate its utilization of schools. This study was intended to determine the most efficient way to operate the normal-based district schools based on future enrollment projections. The study's planning team recently discussed that schools within an enrollment near or below 150 students are not sustainable, and the cost to operate them is too great to keep them open. As of September 2025, Carlock Elementary School had 93 students. Its average classroom size was 18 students in the 2024-25 year, according to data from the Illinois Report Card. Jillian Nelson said the school's average cost growth over the last 5 years was 19%, compared to the 41% average cost growth of the district. It is also one of only four schools in the district that is projected to experience an increase in enrollment over the next 10 years. Carlock Mayor Rhonda Baer also addressed the closure's impact on the community through decreased real estate values and a loss of funding for police and fire services. Advocates also pointed to the school's ranking as exemplary on the Illinois Report Card, which means it is among the top 10% of highest performing schools in the state. It has held this designation for 4 of the last 7 fiscal years. A public information session to review the district's options is scheduled for 6 p.m. February 19th at Parkside Junior High School. Cropper will then present its final recommendations during the school board's March 18th meeting. The board could then take action on any recommendations as early as April 15th. The board, which met at Normal West High School, also approved a roughly $3.2 million roof replacement for Kingsley Junior High School. According to a letter to the board from Joe Edelman, Unit 5 Executive Director of Operations, temporary repairs have been made to address 38 areas of wet insulation on the roof. However, a permanent fix is required, and therefore staff recommend using Tremco, the same Ohio-based contractor the district used to fix Normal Community High School's roof last summer, to fix Kingsley's roof. The project will be paid solely out of the school's county facility sales tax revenue, and to manage costs, the project will be split into two phases that will occur over the next 2 summers. And we return now to some local and state news. This story is headlined, "Man Accused of Drug Sales," Dateline, Bloomington. Excuse me. A man from Normal has been accused of selling cocaine to a police informant and was detained in the McLean County Jail. Cortez D. Arrington, 31, is charged with 2 Class 1 felony counts of unlawful delivery of a controlled substance after police said he sold 1 to 15 grams of cocaine to the informant on 2 separate occasions. The defendant appeared Wednesday before Judge Amy McFarland for his initial court appearance. Assistant State's Attorney Jeffrey Horvey argued to the judge that Arrington posed a danger to the community that could not be mitigated by conditions lesser than detention. According to the probable cause statement, these charges came about following a McLean County Sheriff's Office narcotics investigation into drug sales. On December 27, 2025, police spoke with a confidential source who described the defendant, indicating Arrington sells anywhere from a ball to a kilo of cocaine. The prosecutor noted that a ball is a commonly known street phrasing for an eighth of an ounce. The source told police that Arrington frequently changes his phone number to avoid detection, but the source provided his current phone number to police. Horvey said the first buy occurred Wednesday, December 31st, in which the informant placed an order with Arrington, who showed up to the meat location in a car. He sold the informant 2.1 grams of cocaine, Horvey said. The second sale took place January 8th, when the defendant accepted an order and directed the informant to the meat location, he added. Another individual had been directed to show up and complete the deal for 2.04 grams for $500. The identification of the third party has not yet been confirmed, Horvey said. Then, on Tuesday, January 27th, police made contact with the defendant at his home, where they saw the defendant get out of a vehicle, go into another car for about 2 minutes, and return to the car he had previously been in, Horvey said. Arrington drove away, Horvey said, and the police then stopped the car in Normal. Officers arrested Arrington based on the probable cause from the two transactions. During his arrest, Arrington was found in possession of $325 suspected drug proceeds, Horvey said. He spoke to detectives, and when asked how long he had been selling drugs, Arrington responded, "Not for long," and then said he had not been selling drugs, Horvey said. Instead, Arrington suggested he was bringing money to a friend when police saw him go between the two cars, not committing a drug deal, Horvey said. However, the detectives noted he often posted on social media about selling drugs. When confronted about the social media posts, Arrington confirmed the accounts were his, but said he had been posting for a friend to whom he would refer potential customers if they were interested in buying drugs, Horvey said. He made 3 calls from jail, which were monitored, and all indicated his guilt of the offense, Horvey said. In the first call, Arrington reportedly said, "They got me, dog. I knew it was coming." To another caller, he said, "I think somebody snitched, but it ain't like nothing but 1 to 15 grams. And then on his final phone call, he said he came into the jail high after swallowing everything, which was consistent with what police suspected, Horvey said. In arguing for his release, Assistant Public Defender Stuart Wallace said the defendant had recently been ordered by an Indiana court to begin paying child support for his 2 minor children. He said the defendant has been seeking employment and noted, "It seems to me that perhaps the conduct that brings him here today was in attempts to comply with that order." The defense attorney pointed out that Arrington does not face allegations of intentional violence or access to weapons. He asked that he be released with home confinement and electronic monitoring. But Horvey disagreed, noting a long history of offenses, noncompliance with court orders, and unsuccessful termination of probations. "Not only does he not care about anybody else, he doesn't care about himself," said Horvey, noting that Arrington may have swallowed pills to not have been caught in possession upon his arrest. "It's ridiculous." In making her decision, McFarland cited the jail calls, finding the state had met its burden. "You'd have to live under a rock to not understand the danger cocaine has on this community," the judge said, noting cases where dangerous drugs, such as cocaine, have been laced with deadly drugs. And Arrington will next appear in court for arraignment February 13th at 9 a.m. And this story is headlined, "Lawmaker Says Be Wary of Closing Schools," Dateline Normal. While the members of the Carlock community continue to speak out against a proposed closure of Carlock Elementary School, U.S. Representative Raja Krishnamoorthy, Democrat of Schaumburg, said this week he has experience with school closures and recommended administrators use caution when making that decision. "I don't want to get into a specific school closure because I'm sure that the parents, teachers, students, and administrators are working through it in general," Krishnamoorthy said Tuesday while at Fairview Elementary School to talk to administrators and staff about federal funding cuts being made to its after-school programs. "I'm from Peoria. I represent the suburbs, and I saw this happen in the Chicago area." The visit to Fairview was part of 3 stops across the state, during which Krishnamoorthy highlighted the impact of federal cuts to community resources. Krishnamurthy is among the top three candidates, along with Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton and U.S. Representative Robin Kelly of Linwood, who are vying for the Democratic nomination to succeed U.S. Senator Dick Durbin in the March 17th primary. On Wednesday, around 20 supporters urged the McLean County Unit 5 School Board not to close Carlock after an enrollment planning study determined it was not sustainable to keep the elementary school open last month. Although he said he did not want to get into the specifics of Carlock's potential closure, Krishnamurthy told reporters he has seen this happen in the Chicagoland area in 2013, when 50 public schools closed, primarily on the city's south and west side. That was a traumatic experience for parents because a lot of these places were safe zones for their children, in addition to being learning centers, Krishnamurthy said. Whenever something like that happens, you obviously have to be very careful and cautious and make sure there's plenty of communication. Otherwise, you could have a real challenge on your hands and it could get in the way of more progress on other issues. And this story is headlined, Police Say Teens Had Loaded Handguns, Dateline Bloomington. Two 17-year-old McLean County boys have been arrested after police said they had a loaded handgun. According to a Wednesday press release, Bloomington police were investigating a 17-year-old with an active McLean County arrest warrant. Officers conducted a traffic stop on a vehicle occupied by the juvenile in the 700 block of West College Avenue in Normal. The wanted juvenile was arrested without incident and was found to be in possession of a loaded handgun, the release said. Bloomington Police Information Officer Bryce Jansen confirmed that the juvenile with the warrant was a passenger of the vehicle and that the police department were following the vehicle from Bloomington to Normal. Another passenger, a 17-year-old male from Leroy, was arrested on a charge of possession of cannabis, and a search of the vehicle found a second loaded handgun. Besides the warrant and cannabis possession, each was charged with aggravated unlawful use of a weapon. Both were transported to the McLean County Juvenile Detention Center, and their identities are not being released due to their age. And here are some news briefs. Heartland displays art by veterans. Artwork from Heartland Community College student veterans will be on display through March 6th at the Joe McCauley Gallery in the Instructional Commons Building on the Normal campus. The exhibit is in room 2507 and open from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Thursday and 9 to noon on Friday on days the college is open. Groups can also make appointments to visit the exhibit. Heartland will hold an artist reception with student artists at the gallery at 5 p.m. Tuesday, February 3rd. Students are dedicating the exhibit to classmate Nancy Benedict, who died last year, and collaborated to finish their classmates' unfinished artwork, according to a news release from the college. Students who enroll in the Creativets Intro to Veteran Art course have their tuition and expenses for the class paid for through a partnership with the nonprofit organization Creativets, founded by Heartland alumnus Richard Casper. Veterans interested in learning more about the course can contact the Veterans Center staff at 309-268-8153 or at the Penn Family Student Veterans Center, located in the Workforce Development Center on the main campus at 1500 West Rab Road. And lawmakers seek Ballantines for seniors. Dateline Pontiac. Three Republican state lawmakers are encouraging residents to participate in the annual Valentines for Seniors card drive. Cards are being accepted now through February 2nd. Every Valentine's card we receive means so much to a senior who may not always get visitors or kind words, State Senator Chris Balkema, Republican of Shanahan, said in a statement. A simple card can lift someone's spirits and remind them of the love and respect we have for our seniors who have given so much to our communities. According to a news release, this year's card drive is part of a broader statewide effort by Senate Republicans to collect and deliver thousands of Valentines to seniors across Illinois. Joining Balkema were State Representatives Jason Bunting of Emmington and Dennis Tipsord of Metamora. And cards can be dropped off at the following district offices: 305 West Madison Street in Pontiac, 132 East Main Street in Dwight, 125 West Front Street in El Paso, and 1001 East Grant Street in Watseka. Drop-off hours are 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. Individuals planning to deliver cards in person are encouraged to call ahead. And you can visit senatorchrisbalkema.com/events or call Balkema's office at 815-844-9179 for more information. And here's Susan Haslett's column titled, "Surgery Can Be a Laughing Matter." Medical procedures, even minor ones, seem to bring out our true selves. Personality traits that we normally try to mask, such as fussiness or impatience, can be revealed under a bright spotlight, or should I say, an operating room light. My husband, for instance, turns to comedy if he's been sitting in a medical facility for too long. Recently, while waiting in a pre-op area, he entertained his audience of one, me, by blowing up a blue examination glove until it resembled a balloon in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, and then he drew a smiling face on it and made it talk like a puppet. I confess that anticipating a medical procedure can make me a little jittery. Years ago, my doctor recommended I have a partial thyroidectomy, but I kept stalling. "Sorry, doc, can't do it this month, business trip. Next month, vacation. Month after that? Nope, we're getting the carpets cleaned." I'd never been a patient in a hospital, and when I mentioned the upcoming surgery to friends, they shared their own medical tales of woe. Then I got really nervous. The morning of the appointment finally arrived. "What's this?" my husband said, pointing to an overstuffed suitcase at the top of the stairs. "You're only spending one night." "I need my pink pajamas and slippers and a book to read and..." Dragging the luggage, he headed to the garage. "Oh, rats," I heard him say. The car had a flat tire. "This is a bad omen," I said. "Cancel the appointment. It's a sign to stay home." He quickly repaired the leak and, to my disappointment, opened my car door. After our traditional disagreement over the quickest route to take to reach our destination, we missed the entrance to the parking lot and had to circle the hospital several times. "It's this way." "No, that's a one-way street." "I'm going to end up in the ER for high blood pressure because you won't ask for directions." "We can see it from here. I don't need directions." Well, eventually we checked in. My husband walked like a pack mule with the suitcase. The registration person was so concerned she asked if he needed a wheelchair. A friendly nurse took my vitals, handed me a plastic cup, and pointed to the restroom. "We need a sample." How am I supposed to produce a sample when I've been fasting for 12 hours? Now dressed in the standard-issue backless hospital gown, I sat in the restroom. I could hear my husband outside the door. "You know I can't go to the bathroom with you listening," I shouted. "Go away. I have a very shy bladder." "Well, it's the only part of you that is shy. Everyone in the hallway just got a glimpse of your posterior. Close your gown." Well, I emerged from the bathroom, specimen in hand. "That's my girl," he said. I removed all jewelry and handed my wedding ring to the man who gave it to me. "Don't lose it," I said. "Oh, I think there's a pawn shop around the corner." "Will you be serious? Do you have any last words you want to say to me?" "Well, I only promise till death do us part." The nurse came. It was time. My husband smiled and added, "But that day won't be today." A few hours later, when I opened my eyes, he was there talking to my mother. "Oh, she's fine, but I think I hurt my back." The staff fussed over him and helped him to a chair. And since that day long ago, our family has been blessed with mostly good health. Thank goodness. No one wants a large collection of smiley-faced balloons made from medical gloves. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantograph of Friday, January 30th, 2026. I look forward to reading part two next.